Devin is 15 years old, straight A student, a top grade soccer player, and an Olympic hopeful. So how did she wind up in jail, charged with trying to murder her newborn baby? After is a new novel for young adults by Amy Ifaw. It's a different direction from Ms. Ifaw, whose first novel, Battle Dress, was based on her experience as a West Point cadet. Amy Ifaw joins us now from the studios of member station KCFR in Denver. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Scott, for having me.
A young girl who leaves her newborn in a garbage, this would not seem to be a sympathetic hero.
No, not at all. Because I think we who hear these stories when we're driving around, we have these preconceptions about what these girls are like. We think they're monsters. But I did a lot of research on this subject when I decided to write this book. And I discovered that my preconception was completely wrong. That these girls typically are not described as a meth mom, but more accurately described as sort of a poster child for the American high achiever.
Well, let me get you to follow up on that, because Devin is, in fact, a high achiever. And I, as part of what you learned, I think some people listening will find it incredible that that anybody, but particularly somebody as in tune with her body as presumably a 15-year-old high-caliber athlete is, would not know that she was pregnant.
You know, I think people see what they want to see, and they don't want to see what they don't want to see. The very core of this phenomenon, which is a real phenomenon, is denial. Denial is the core. And so if a young girl like my main character, Devin, is denying the fact that she even had a sexual relationship at all, because dealing with that was just too painful for her for her own reasons, then, of course, there can't be a resulting pregnancy from that. So it's a personal denial, but it's also a community denial. As we read the story and we learn more about Devin's life, we see that the people closest to her didn't acknowledge the pregnancy either. They didn't confront the denial. And so she can go on unhindered in her denial until the moment where she's alone by herself in a bathroom and goes into labor.
A lot of parents may not want their teenage daughters, teenage sons for that matter, to read this book.
You know, I've had this discussion with people before. And first of all, a lot of people don't like their children to read disturbing books because they think their kids are going to somehow get involved in this activity. The argument that a girl is going to read this book and then say, you know, I can't wait to I get pregnant so I can throw my baby in a garbage can. So that argument sort of kind of falls apart. But I think there are benefits to the story. This is a story about a girl who, I would say about a third way through her sophomore year, starts withdrawing into herself. She stops participating in class, and she skips out on her soccer practices. She doesn't respond to text messages from her friends. Yet nobody acknowledges the fact that she sort of dropped off the radar. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of kids feel invisible. And so a book like this can validate their feelings and help them realize that they're not alone. There are other kids, unfortunately, that are feeling exactly like they are. Mm-hmm. But then for the kids who aren't feeling isolated or alone, a book like this can help them empathize with the kids around them who are. It is a disturbing and taboo subject. There's a lot of silence that surrounds mm-hmm. a subject like this. And that's what sort of inspired me to write this book in the first place is, I don't know what it says about me, but I'm intrigued sort of with the things that people don't want to talk about, the darker side of human nature.
How does a West Point cadet wind up being a novelist for young readers? I mean, imagine a lot of your classmates are, you know, at this point, tank commanders or something.
You know, I think a preconception about West Pointers is that they're sort of military robots. But
We don't think that.
You don't think that?
No, but also we don't think of West Point cadets as budding novelists.
Right, exactly. It is kind of a strange thing. I would say that my experience at West Point was the classes were geared towards engineering, which is not my forte at all. But, you know, I think a writer takes things from their life and puts it on paper in a way that people can relate to. So I think you can be any kind of person. And once I was done with my commitment as an Army officer, this is what I decided to do.
You have five children. How old is your oldest, may I ask?
She just turned 18 in 18. July.
She read your books? Did she read this one?
Yes. My daughter, Alex, is a kid who loves fantasy books. So to get her to read my book was hard. But she read the book, and she actually read an early draft of it and gave me some suggestions, which I thought was great. And in fact, I also have a 16-year-old daughter and a 14-year-old daughter. And my 16-year-old told me over and over again how boring my book is and how she'd never want to read it. And when she finally read it, she's like, oh my goodness, this is an amazing book. I can't believe my mom wrote this.
That's better than Publishers Weekly, and they like your books.
It is, because it kind of bothered me. It took me 7 years to write this book. And for one of my daughters to actually tell me that she couldn't stop reading it was a huge compliment.
Miss Efall, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me, Scott. It was great.
And you can read an excerpt of Amy Efall's After and find reviews, more current fiction and nonfiction, on our website, npr.org.
The latest blockbuster novel from Dan Brown traffics in surprising twists and turns. And in real life, it's been quite a twist and turn for Marilyn Schlitz.
Waking up one morning to find yourself a fictional character in a best-selling novel has taken a little adjusting, too, but we're working on it.
That's right. Schlitz, or a version of her, is in the novel. NPR's Barbara Bradley Haggerty tells her story.
The day before The Lost Symbol arrived in bookstores, Marilyn Schlitz began to notice some unusual traffic on Twitter. Rumor had it that the heroine in the book was a woman at the Institute of Noetic Sciences, which researches things like consciousness and healing. Schlitz bought the book the next day and read into the wee hours.
As I'm reading along and I'm hearing the descriptions of the types of research that she's doing and the kinds of data that she's using to support her case, my husband would be falling asleep and I'd be jabbing him, listen to this, you know. It was really very surprising and delightful at the same time.
Surprising, because Dan Brown never contacted the Institute, yet he seemed to know all about their research, even the fact that they had built a 2,000-pound electromagnetically shielded laboratory, which Brown calls the Cube. Then, on the day of publication, contact.
Dan Brown sent a very sweet email saying, as you know, I'm a big fan of the Institute of Noetic Sciences, and I'd hope to give you a heads up, but because of security around the book, he wasn't able to, but hoping we were enjoying the attention.
You might say so. Traffic to their website has increased 12-fold. New members are joining up, and places like NBC Dateline, not to mention NPR, are calling for interviews. At the center of The Lost Symbol is Catherine Solomon, who helps Brown's returning hero, Harvard professor Robert Langdon, solve the mysteries of Freemasonry gone wrong. This being a thriller, there is a hint of romantic tension. Here's how Catherine is described.
Catherine Solomon had been blessed with the resilient Mediterranean skin of her ancestry, and even at 50 years old, she had a smooth olive complexion. She used almost no makeup and wore her thick black hair unstyled and down. She had gray eyes and slender patrician elegance.
Short of long black hair and olive skin and a wealthy family, there were a lot of similarities in terms of the research, maybe not so much my looks.
Schlitz has short reddish hair and fair skin, but there are several similarities. Like Catherine, Schlitz's father and brother were Masons. Both women studied distant intention, prayer, and healing, and both believed that ancient wisdom traditions predicted discoveries in modern science. Schlitz says she can identify 10 experiments by her institute in The Lost Symbol, but she says there's a lot of science fiction in the book. I won't spoil the plot, but there's a death and resurrection. That's an experiment that's never been done. Then there's this passage.
Catherine's work had begun using modern science to answer ancient philosophical questions. Does anyone hear our prayers? Is there life after death? Do humans have souls? Incredibly, Catherine had answered all these questions and more, scientifically, conclusively.
Really?
No. So that's a bit of a stretch, and at the same time, I think those are the compelling questions that science should be looking at. They're also the taboo topics that science doesn't want to look at.
And thanks to The Lost Symbol, there's probably going to be a lot more interest and money to research those questions. Barbara Bradley Haggerty, NPR News.
The big news in the world of books last week was that German writer Herta Mueller won the Nobel Prize. The big news in the world of books this week is that the fourth novel in Jeff Kinney's wildly best-selling Diary of a Wimpy Kid series for preteens has just hit bookstores, and it's the number one bestseller on Amazon.com. Book critic Maureen Carrigan says it was hard to decide which milestone to focus on, but comedy ultimately triumphed.
Our local independent bookstore opened extra early on the morning of October 12th to sell copies of the insanely anticipated latest book in Jeff Kinney's Diary of a Wimpy Kid series, this one entitled Dog Days. The last time I remember that bookstore being overrun with hordes of kids yelping for a book was when the final Harry Potter novel came out. It was midnight when the Potter boxes were broken open and the kids were dressed as macabre creatures from Hogwarts. The atmosphere surrounding the arrival of Kinney's latest book was appropriately sprightlier. The bookstore opened at dawn, after all, and distributed donuts. Like the Potter series, Kinney's books are aimed at a middle school audience, but translate well to older readers. Unlike the Potter series, Kinney's books are funny, the kind of funny where you have to stop reading every so often because you're laughing so hard, tears and snot are running down your face, and you feel like maybe you'll even throw up. How's that for an erudite critical endorsement? I started reading Kinney at the command of my 11-year-old daughter. One of the things she hates most in the world is when adults loom over her and ask, "So, are you a big reader like your mother?" She's not. She's much more socially well-adjusted than I am and doesn't seek out quiet corners where she can seal herself off with a book, far from the madding crowd. She soured on the Potter saga about halfway through when the storylines got grislier. Kinney, however, is just her ticket. Not only is his series hero, Greg Heffley, a middle school everyman, forever waiting for his growth spurt as he's surrounded by gorilla classmates who need to shave twice a day, but the books themselves are stories in cartoon form, otherwise known as graphic novels. Because the conceit of the series is that the books themselves are journals that Greg is keeping, the cartoons here are strictly stick figure. But what a range of middle school misery Kinney wrings out of a few lines. The bend of Greg's back under a jumbotron-sized book bag, the quaking of his scrawny body as he's perched on the edge of the freezing school pool, waiting for the swim meet whistle to blow and seal his doom. The cartoons don't merely illustrate the story, they advance it and split it off into 100 digressive tributaries, working like the footnotes in Eliot's Wasteland. Admittedly, maybe I'm reaching for a high art analogy because I'm still a little uncomfortable about my kid preferring to read what amounts to a hardcover comic book series over, say, Little Women. But Kinney has anticipated this kind of helicopter parent squeamishness. In Dog Days, Greg Heffley's relentlessly chirpy mom starts a summer reading club. At the first meeting, the other boys report on the books they've brought, among them Sudoku Insanity and Extreme Pop-Up Sharks. Greg's mom says these books aren't real literature and insists that the club is going to have to start with the classics. Greg says that he's not really sure what makes a book a classic, but he thinks it has to be at least 50 years old, and some person or animal has to die at the end. He says these are the type of books teachers are always pushing us to read at school, and that if you read a classic in your free time, the teachers reward you with a sticker of a hamburger or something like that. Clearly, Kinney has an ear and eye for the middle school milieu. for adult readers, he vividly brings back the oceanic feeling of helplessness that swamps most of us at that age when you're not in control of your weirdly changing body or, much of the time, even what you're allowed to eat or read. Last spring, in the delirious company of my daughter and two of her middle school guy friends, I heard Jeff Kinney speak at the University of Maryland. It was one of the best author talks I've ever attended. Kinney had the whole cavernous auditorium, adults, kids, roaring with laughter. Kinney gets the powerlessness of late childhood. In his appearance that day and throughout his ongoing series, he's made all the wimpy kids out there know that they're in good company.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Diary of a Wimpy Kid, Dog Days by Jeff Kinney. I'm Terry Gross.